Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
And good afternoon. It is wonderful to be here with you, and good morning in the Pacific time zone. It is wonderful to be here with you, keeping you company for the next 3 hours here on the EIB Network and the Rush Limbaugh Show. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict continues, and it's an incredible thing to watch because one of the first stories I have in front of me is already causing me to question whether or not I ought to even share it, because it's a story written by the Associated Press. Israel strikes Gaza tunnels as truce efforts remain elusive. The Israeli military unleashed another heavy wave of airstrikes Monday on the Gaza Strip, saying it destroyed militant tunnels and the homes of 9 Hamas commanders. International diplomacy to end the week-long war that has killed hundreds appeared to make little headway. In fact, overnight, you had the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, taking out a senior Hamas commander, putting out a video of the strike on his house, and noting at the on the tweet attached to it that he's carried out many terrorist attacks. He's not carrying out any more terrorist attacks. He's gone. He's done. It's over. Why am I concerned about doing this story by Ferez Akram and Ravi Nesman? Because it's the Associated Press. These are the same people that tried to tell you that they didn't know, that they had no idea that Hamas was in the building, in the Gaza media building over the weekend that was taken down by the IDF. Why, we've been there for 20 years. We had no inkling that Hamas was in there. Even though, of course, Israel provided proof to many of the world leaders, including the United States government, prompting Anthony Blinken, our Secretary of State, to come out and say, that was a righteous takedown of that building. Hamas was there. We believe Hamas was there. AP didn't know. Absolutely amazing. We've got great stuff coming throughout the next 3 hours, hitting on all cylinders, as Rush would have us do. Yesterday on Fox, former Deputy National Security Advisor KT McFarland spoke about the ramifications of the Biden administration reversing Trump policy.
What they're doing is they have to sort of bend to the wishes of these radical leftists. And what do the radical leftists want? They hate Israel. They're anti-Semitic. And so they pushed the Biden administration to reverse everything Trump did, including in the Middle East. I mean, we understood in the Middle East you could only get to peace if you cut the funding and the weapon sources from the Palestinian terrorists. We did that with the Abraham Accords, which got the Arabs to stop funding the Palestinian terrorists. And with Iran, with the sanctions, we got Iran so broke, their economy so broken, they couldn't afford to send aid to the Palestinian terrorists. So we were on our way to peace, but now it's all been reversed. And now what do you see in the Middle East? Predictably, you have war.
When Democrats are in charge, all of your friends become enemies and all of your enemies become friends. You have this weird use of language from people like Jen Psaki, who was right there during the failed years of the Obama administration's foreign policy. She was a spokesperson for the State Department and a senior communications official in the Obama administration. She's now coming out. You remember when Hillary Clinton spoke of soft diplomacy? Soft diplomacy. We could do soft diplomacy. Yesterday, the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, referred to quiet diplomacy.
Our calculation at this point is that having those conversations behind the scenes, weighing in with our important strategic partnership we have with Israel, also with other countries in the region, is the most constructive approach we can take. So our approach is through quiet, intensive diplomacy, and that's where we feel we can be most effective.
Think about people who support you, that are your friends, that are people who will stand up for you in tough times. Do you want quiet diplomacy in that case? No, you want to have a full-throated support of what you're doing. You defend your allies. Israel is an ally. Quiet diplomacy, I don't know what that means. You know, soft, quiet diplomacy. Rush spoke of Hillary Clinton's soft diplomacy and how that approach rarely works.
Hillary was the keynote speaker for a Beijing conference put on by Kejing magazine. She addressed the audience via video conference setup. According to Hillary, both Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping have it all wrong when it comes to North Korea. She says that they need to soften their attitude toward North Korea's little pot-bellied dictator, Kim Jong-un. They need to try to stop relying on bluster and personal taunts to motivate him to behave better. Hillary warned that if Trump and China do not pursue a policy of soft diplomacy, nuclear war might be the result. Beijing should remember that inaction is a choice, she said. Ironically, she gave her remarks the same day the little dictator fired off an ICBM that landed in Japanese waters. And yet again, Hillary made it clear that she just can't get over the election results. She told her Chi-Com audience, I was the candidate of reality. It just wasn't as entertaining as the reality TV candidate. Well, here's a dose of reality, Hillary. Your so-called soft diplomacy was tried and tried again with North Korea. It didn't work. It never works. It's why we're where we are. And neither does inaction. You tried that in Benghazi. And we all know how that turned out.
It's abundantly clear, and Rush is 100% correct. It is abundantly clear that a strong America means a more stable world. Hillary Clinton tried to sell herself as some guru, some policy guru, when it came to international affairs and things like that. Her high point was giving a speech, if you remember, at the women's conference in Beijing. That was her high. That was her high water mark when she began to run for president in 2008 after being a senator from New York, and when she became the person in charge of international diplomacy, she cratered our position in the world. Benghazi comes to mind. The selling of our strategic assets to Russian concerns with rare earths and those sorts of things. This is a person who is consistently wrong, only beaten out by Joe Biden, whose portfolio for 40 years was, he's brilliant on foreign policy. He understands foreign policy. It was Joe Biden who penned with Leslie Gelb in the Washington Post in 2003 and 2004 the idea that we should take American troops and partition Iraq into sectarian groups using American military personnel as essentially bullet stoppers between the sectarian groups. That's a terrible idea. Joe Biden has never been right. Bob Gates, I referenced this yesterday. Bob Gates ran the CIA, ran the Defense Department. He's a guy who's been around Washington, D.C. forever. And he said in an interview back in June of 2020, the Wall Street Journal, he said, Joe Biden has never been right on foreign policy in 50 years of being involved. 50 years. You would think on some level he'd back into being right. He's not. He's absolutely not. And so when you have people get into office, and let's just go with the immediate past, shall we? The immediate past 25, 30 years. You have Bill Clinton chasing Yasser Arafat all over the compound there in Maryland, trying to talk to him into cutting a deal with the Israelis. The Israelis offered him 97% of what he wanted. Yasser Arafat wouldn't take the deal. And yet Bill Clinton still was committed to pursuing that failed policy with the PLO. You look at what happened with George W. Bush, who came into office talking about having a humble foreign policy, right? It was going to do a humble foreign policy. Well, 9/11 changed everything. And the Democrats opposed being aggressive on al-Qaeda around the world. They opposed it. They didn't want to see America doing that. They didn't like that America was defending herself aggressively throughout the world. They were upset by that. Then you get into the years of Barack Obama and Joe Biden. And we had a preseason for Joe Biden, and that was when he was the vice president for Barack Obama, for President Obama. And Joe Biden told us where he stood with Barack Obama. Don't go kill bin Laden. He bragged about that. I told him, don't go try a couple of other things. Don't go kill bin Laden. What? Even Republicans, even the most conservative conservatives, were happy that bin Laden was killed. Joe Biden was the last guy in the room, said, Dad, don't do it. Try something else first. Don't do it yet. He was wrong. I'm sure he advised Barack Obama to allow the Russians to come in and take up the position in Laktia there in Syria after Barack Obama put his red line in the sand and said, don't you gas your people, Assad. And the minute Assad gassed his people, suddenly Barack Obama's calling on the phone to Vladimir Putin, say, Vlad, can you help me out here? Can you get Can you get me out of a jam, out of a pickle? Can you bring Russians into Syria for the first time in history? Give them a Mediterranean port and get me out of the jam of confronting Assad? And for good measure, they turned around and sent pallets full of cash to the mullahs in Tehran to pay them for not proliferating, even though they took that cash, spread it throughout the Middle East, groups like Hamas, groups like Hezbollah, groups like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, to kill Israelis, to kill Jews, to kill Americans, to kill Arabs. This is a failed foreign policy being rolled out, and they want to call it quiet diplomacy. I'd be embarrassed, too. I'd be whispering about my quiet diplomacy if it was this bad. They can't even manage the foreign policy crisis that is the American border. You think they can manage Gaza and Israel? No way. No way. This is a group that is not ready for prime time. They are running a dangerous foreign policy that doesn't consider America's strategic interests nor our allies' strategic interests, and instead want to chase ghosts of international celebration and adoration coming in from places like Tehran and Gaza. No thank you, President Biden. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host here on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Iron Dome. You keep hearing people talk about Iron Dome. It's for shorthand, it's the protective missile defense system that Israel uses against these rockets being fired in from Gaza. And it's got in its deepest roots one of our greatest presidents. The Iron Dome in Israel is one of President Reagan's lasting legacies. His belief that the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, Star Wars, they used to decry it as, and the partial U.S. funding for this initial technology development helped Israel with this incredibly important defense. In fact, back in 2014, an editorial in the Washington Examiner, Ronald Reagan's missile defense vision is saving lives in Israel. Liberals scoffed in 1983 when President Ronald Reagan first proposed the Strategic Defense Initiative missile defense system. They called it Star Wars and claimed the technology was fictional. Other critics took a different tact, arguing that Star Wars would be harmful if it did work, because it would upset the delicate nuclear balance between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. See, we had to be willing to take a nuclear strike on our soil to prove that we were good guys, as the Soviets were concerned. Well, 3 decades after Reagan's landmark proposal, technical issues moot. This week, it's 2014, the world has watched Israel's Iron Dome system, partially funded by the U.S. and incorporating U.S. technology, perform remarkably well against more than 1,000 Hamas rockets fired from the Gaza Strip. See, we've been down this road before. Hamas does this every 5, 6, 7 years when they get a hankering for a conflict. So if not for the Iron Dome protecting Israel from all the incoming rocket fire, I shudder to think what the civilian casualties would be right now. In fact, here's Rush talking about Iron Dome in 2014. He was illustrating absurdity in this clip, but what he actually said became a reality.
Folks, just to show you, we just had a caller who wanted to know about the, why was there no coverage on the Iron Dome? The Israeli Iron Dome, it's protecting their children from these attacks by Hamas. And I said, one of the reasons why it's not fair that Israel is the one who has the Iron Dome, and they haven't shared the Iron Dome with the Palestinians and Hamas. Lo and behold, a story from today in the Washington Times, UN condemns Israel and the United States for not sharing Iron Dome with Hamas. Good. Folks, my instincts some days even amaze me. Nations slammed Israel for possibly committing war crimes in its fight against Hamas, and then backed that accusation by suggesting the Jewish state ought to be sharing its Iron Dome defensive technology with the very terror group it's fighting. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay said to members of the media at an emergency meeting of the UN Human Rights Council that Israel was falling short in its duty to protect citizens in the Gaza Strip from getting killed by its rockets by not sharing its technology. Is that not cockeyed? This is a war. We are in a war, and the Israelis are being condemned for not sharing their protective dome so that the Palestinians can be protected from Israeli rockets. That's exactly how this works. If you understand, I don't mean this to sound condescending. Please, never. I never mean to sound that way. The way to not go insane trying to make sense out of this. You know, how in the world could Israel be the bad guy? How in the world can this be? The only democratic country in the Middle East, a U.S. ally ever since its founding, since Israel's founding. How can it be? How can Israel end up being the bad guy? Obama makes it look like the bad guy. John Kerry makes him look like the bad guy, which makes it look like they agree with Hamas and the Palestinians or the other Arab states that Israel's a bad guy. How can Israel be the bad guy? They're the ones under assault. They're the ones being attacked. Israel doesn't put kids on its bombs, send them into Gaza Strip. Palestinians do that. How in the world is Israel the bad guy? Do you understand that in the leftist perverted worldview, Israel is the bad guy because they're the more powerful and they are a majority and they're more advanced? It isn't fair. It just isn't fair. I mean, if Israel has an Iron Dome, they should share that. They should share it. Palestinians are a poor, underdeveloped minority. They're victims. And the Israelis are the brutes and the bullies. It's no more complicated than that. Well, it is. But I mean, that's a simple way of understanding it.
Rush is spot on. And one of the most overlooked parts of this conversation is the historical test that proves that Rush was right back in 2014, but also that Israel is a state that practices restraint. Go back to the days of the first Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was routinely firing Scud missiles into Israel in the hopes that things would escalate. And it was George H.W. Bush and that leadership team that got on the phone to the Israeli government and said, listen, we got Patriot missiles. We're going to help you out. Don't escalate this. Hussein is trying to create a regional war. Just be restrained. And we know it's hard that you're taking missile strikes on your country. Remember Arthur Kent, the Scud stud, who would report live from Jerusalem? The Israelis showed tremendous restraint because they understood the bigger picture. But more than that, they understood that if they're taking incoming rocket fire and we're putting the United States' good name on the line to defend our ally, they can trust us. Now what? Well, when you have people in the Obama administration or connected to the Obama administration or the Biden administration talking crazy about diplomacy with the Palestinians and we can work this out, ask yourself this question. If the Iranians really cared about the Palestinians, why would they just send them missiles? Why wouldn't they advocate on their behalf for some sort of a normalization? Why wouldn't Syria do that? Why wouldn't Lebanon do that? Why wouldn't the Russians do that? Instead, they watch the carnage in Gaza and in Israel. And as far as they're concerned, it's just another day in a rough neighborhood. This is a tragedy for the Palestinians because they're being played by their alleged allies who are just using them as pawns. They ought to rethink this fight against Israel and rethink the notion of a functioning political system side by side with the other states. But they won't, because Iran has radicalized them. I'm Brett Winterbull, EID Network. The never-ending confusion involving the CDC guidelines and masks and when you can wear masks and when you should wear masks and where you must wear masks and don't wear masks, all that sort of stuff. It seems that the more leadership talks about CDC guidelines and masks, the more confusion there is. Yesterday, President Biden issued a strong statement to the unvaccinated.
Ultimately, those who are not vaccinated will end up paying the price.
What kind of language is that? Ultimately, those who are not vaccinated will end up paying the price. What price is that? Cases continue to decline. Fatalities are at an all-time low. Yet, we're getting mixed messages around the virus? When asked about the possibility of vaccine passports. Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this.
It has not changed our view that the federal government will not be playing that role. The private sector may, and it may prompt the private sector moving forward on actions, which is where we think it's appropriately situated.
I love this wordplay that Jen Psaki is very adept at using. So if you take apart what she just said, it has not changed our view that the federal government will not be playing that role. The private sector may. That's in regards to the vaccine passports. And it may prompt the private sector moving forward on actions, which is where we think it's appropriately situated. So it may prompt the private sector. You mean command the private sector. Because remember, if you go get on an airplane right now, they tell you that you have to wear a mask. And it's weird because they use this quasi-official sounding language about being masked on an airplane. It's not a law that says you have to wear a mask on an airplane. What it is, it's an executive order from President Biden. But when you go into airports, you'll say, according to the law, you must wear a mask in the airport and on the airplanes, right? They have varying sort of messaging like that. No, it's an executive order. And he has ordered that you wear masks on airplanes. And the airlines have complied with that. Nobody has stood up and said, no, we're going to be a mask-free airline. No, we're going to play ball with that. So the idea that she uses, where like, it may prompt the private sector moving forward on actions in the same way we're doing quiet diplomacy. We're just prompting. And then you got the president saying, well, those who are unvaccinated, they'll pay. Those who are not vaccinated will pay and pay the price. Very, very autocratic, very authoritarian. And then she comes out with the soft soap there. Well, New York Governor Cuomo backed this up, announcing that Radio City Music Hall will reopen at 100% capacity with one caveat, only for vaccinated people.
The magnificent Radio City Music Hall, 100% vaccinated, mask-free audience. This beautiful hall will be filled once again, 100% at Radio City Music Hall. So if I'm not vaccinated, I can't go. That's right.
So that's prompting. That's prompting a private concern. The governor saying, no, you can reopen, but everybody's got to be vaccinated. So you got to carry your vaccine passport to go to Radio City Music Hall. How confusing it would be if Joe Biden were to go give a speech at Radio City Music Hall, the White House saying we're not going to force anybody to do a COVID vaccine passport. But you know what? In the state level, Andy Cuomo says you got to do it. You got to do it. There's this incredible fear that has taken root in our country in a way I never thought we would see. It's a strange phenomenon. Because now you've got people who are vaccinated and they're keeping their masks on and maybe keeping them on forever. There was a piece in the New York Times yesterday that's emblematic of what this entire pandemic has done to our society, or at least a big section of our society. It begins like this. Whenever Joe Glickman heads out for groceries, he places an N95 mask over his face and tugs a cloth mask on top of it. Then he puts on goggles. He has used this safety protocol for the past 14 months. It did not change even after he contracted the coronavirus last November. It didn't budge when earlier this month he became fully vaccinated. And even though President Biden said on Thursday that fully vaccinated people do not have to wear a mask, Mr. Glickman said he planned to stay the course. In fact, he plans to do his grocery run double masked and goggled for the next 5 years. Let me reread that sentence because you got to really digest this. Mr. Glickman said he planned to stay the course. He plans to do his grocery run double masked and goggled for the next 5 years. See, I'm really committed. Rush predicted this. So many "see, I told you so's" over the years, right? This is no exception. We've created a fearful society with this pandemic. Even though it's safe by normal standards, people are still terrified. The Institute of Advanced Conservative Studies is its own vaccine in a way, inoculating you from liberal madness. Here is Rush talking to a caller at the beginning of the pandemic who benefited from a dose of EIB.
Philip in Austin, Texas. It's great to have you with us today on the program, sir. Hello.
Good afternoon, Mr. Limbaugh. Professor Limbaugh, it is a distinct honor to be able to speak with you.
Thank you, sir, very much. It's a distinct honor to have you here with us.
A 28-year student of the Rush Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies. It was a proud moment for me to watch you receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Thank you.
And I feel like you're so deserving because you speak truth and life values, and what you've taught to millions of people across different generations, and I'm one of those. And what I've received of huge value from you is not to live in fear. And it harkens back to that previous caller that talked about being able to do what he wanted to do, and he lived without fear and being able to move in that. And so when I see this coronavirus reporting, of course I come to you first, but there's a spattering. I listen out across the other areas, and I've noticed that they are not reporting or in any significant way speaking of the recovery rate, which looks to be commiserate with...
You know, that is really fascinating. I've made the point a couple times. I'm glad you've picked up on that. There is a massive recovery rate that nobody talks about, and it's right here on the Johns Hopkins website.
Yes, sir.
And, you know, you're also so right. Even if they're trying to create an attitude or atmosphere of fear, you don't have to play along with it. You have the ability to reject fear. You have the ability to reject whatever it is that the conventional wisdom of daily news reporting is. You have the ability to reject it.
Yes, sir. May I say one thing?
Yeah.
I feel like not only are you my professor, but you're also a friend and a mentor and somebody that I've looked up to, and I dare say a hero. Due to the values, the true life values that you have expounded out there. I remember many years ago you spoke to some information you had put out about being able to get a job. And you talked about the different levels and what's required and whether it was a high school, college education. And I think that the top level of that had something to do with integrity and respect. And I think that those are parts of values that you teach out there that are invaluable. And I'm thankful that I've been able to experience you for all these years and many years to come.
Why, thank you very much. You know, I'm always flattered and deeply appreciative when I find out how detailed people's listening is. And you have heard the details, and they've obviously made an impression on you. I remember many of the times, not all, I'm sure, but I remember many of the times I've talked about getting a job versus finding a career versus becoming productive versus finding what it is that you are born to do. We are all born to do something, including be lazy. Some people just have to find what they were born to do is. And, yeah, it's a rewarding thing to get calls like yours. I deeply and profoundly appreciate it.
An amazing connection between Rush Limbaugh and the listeners out there. Affected millions and millions and millions of people over the course of the life of this program and of Rush Limbaugh's life. And it's amazing to hear how these lessons, especially to not be fearful, stuck with people all across the decades. We'll take some phone calls straight ahead. 800-282-2882. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Let's check in on the phones and see what folks are talking about. Beth is in San Antonio, Texas, the Alamo City, starting us off. Beth, welcome to the EIB Network. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Brett. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
Well, I appreciate you taking my call and continuing Rush's agenda and what he started for us. I listened to him since the beginning.
Excellent.
And I appreciate you continuing on his efforts.
Thank you.
I'm basically calling because I guess I'm just hearing more and more about the Democrats and how organized they are. And I just feel like we as conservatives need to be organized as well. And I just don't feel like we are. So I just continue to hear all the issues and problems, but not really a lot of solutions.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of organization, how do you see organization manifesting with the Democrats versus the Republicans or versus the conservatives? How is there a difference between the two?
I mean, it's just my opinion, I feel like this has been organized from the beginning. I feel like they perhaps were behind the virus. We really can't say for sure, but we know they certainly took advantage of it by being, organized and knowing that they were going to take advantage of that opportunity to do the mail-in voting. They changed mm-hmm. election law. Mm-hmm. Now we see so many of Trump's policies intentionally reversed immediately,
right,
practically, when Biden came in. I just would like to hear more solutions from what the conservatives or Republicans are doing out there. For instance, when it comes to, say, something as basic as CRT, we hear about it all the time, that it's going to be taught in the public school system.
Yeah.
We're the attorneys that are supposed to speak up against discrimination, because that's what it is. It's discrimination against certain classes and races of people.
Right.
Where are the attorneys trying to look into election law? We don't hear really that the fraud is going to be, reduced or contained, because really, in my opinion, why a lot of these elections were won. And if we don't figure that out, then we're going to continue to have elections that are fraudulent.
So Beth, let's unpack some of this stuff. Georgia passed an election law. A number of other states are passing election reforms in the wake of what we saw. We are seeing activism on the state level in a number of jurisdictions around the country. When it comes to CRT, we just watched an entire school board get turned out in Southlake, Texas, up by Dallas just a couple of weeks ago, because people got together and said, we don't want CRT being taught in the schools. I think we are seeing a tremendous amount of organization. Now, you're not going to see it celebrated on, necessarily on Fox or on MSNBC or CNN or ABC, NBC, CBS. But I think when you look at the commitment of people to keep us energy independent, strong in the world, leading the world, securing our border. I mean, I have no doubt in any of my mind that conservatives are absolutely activated and are ready to go and vote tomorrow. But the problem is, we're 530 plus days away from the next election. So what is happening? Well, you're seeing people stepping up and offering themselves up as candidates at a variety of levels, which is really what we can be doing right now. Conservatives are pretty unique in that they will act independently, but there are organizations that are filing those sorts of lawsuits that you're talking about. J. Christian Adams has filed lawsuits. A number of the conservative organizations are filing lawsuits. The Supreme Court is taking up Roe versus Wade. People are speaking out constantly as it relates to the Keystone XL pipeline. I don't see us in a big rally gathering someplace, but I do see a lot of movement around the country at the micro level, at the city, the state, and the local levels. And I feel very confident that what you're seeing coming from the White House, if that's the best they have to offer, that plus rioting and, disturbances in the street, that's not a recipe for a victory, whether convincing conservatives or moderates or winning an election in 2022. I think they're petrified.
I don't think they are, unfortunately. I mean, I like some of the examples that you used, and I do think it offers some hope. But they're not even being held accountable when these groups go out and riot in the streets. They're not held accountable. They're just released the next day. Why aren't they held accountable? Why don't we have people making sure that they're held accountable instead of just allowing for them to just rotate in and out of the system?
It's because you have a multi-year program, a multi-decade program that's been put into effect to take over Secretary of State's offices, to take over district attorney's offices, state attorney general's offices. This is a committed effort by a revolutionary group of people. I mean, have you thought about maybe getting involved in the political process, running for an office and denying them access to a seat so that you could represent your constituents and friends?
I've thought about it.
You should do it.
But I've thought about it.
Well, you should do it. Who's better than you? You're a lot better than the Castro brothers there in San Antonio. I mean, I think you need to get involved and get going on this. And I'm not being wise guy. I'm being 100% sincere. All of us ought to step up and do it.
takes people getting involved. But, you know, yes. Meanwhile, we've got massive amount of people crossing our border. We've got a great.
Listen. I have no doubt about it. But you know what? I'd rather light the candle than curse the darkness. I am concerned about what's happening out there. And I know millions of people are. But it's going to take us being the people we've been waiting for, to borrow a phrase from a former thought leader. I appreciate the call. We'll take more straight ahead. I'm Brett Witterbull on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. The new podcast series, Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone, is now available to listen to. Every episode will share more stories of our beloved Rush by those he worked with, his friends and his family. Tunnel to Towers Foundation and MyPillow are sponsors. James Golden is the host. And if the first episode is any indication, this is going to be a must-listen. I hope you get the chance. And you can find that first episode if you head on over to rushlimbaugh.com. And you can click on the link right over there to hear that program. And it's remarkable because nobody has a deeper connectivity to Rush than James did in seeing every aspect of this program up close and personally for the amount of time that he was here with us. And, you know, you'll get insights, and then all of a sudden you'll think back about a number of different things Rush may have talked about over the years, and you'll say, ah, it clicks. I get it. I see what's going on there. Coming up in hour number two, we're going to let you hear a little bit from Rush and his trip to Israel.
Now, let's make no mistake about it. There are a whole lot of Islamic nations in the Middle East who want there to be no Israel. And they want to accomplish this by forcing all citizens of Israel to march into the Mediterranean Sea and drown. I guess if you oppose being murdered, it might make you an Islamophobe to these people.
And that's going to be coming up here in the next hour. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide today on the EIB Network. Thrilled to be here. Hour number two underway. And we are going to get into a tremendous discussion that Rush led on a visit to Israel, an unforgettable visit to the nation of Israel. And it's incredible to see the viciousness of the anti-Semitism that is being thrown around from people who are stepping up and stepping out when it comes to challenging what's going on between Israel and Gaza. AOC, the squad, you know, they come to mind. They've had some comments. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez saying that Israel's an apartheid state. There's a CNN freelancer who lost his job for saying that what the world needs today is a Hitler. A Hitler, really. It's an incredible thing to watch as we see the absolute maniacal behavior by people in the streets of European capitals and at protests. There's a convoy that drove through London shouting, blank the Jews, rape their daughters in London. Four were arrested at one of those protests. This is a coarsening of the culture that, I think is shocking in the modern era, in an era that preaches tolerance, acceptance, everything is good. You can say anything you want about Israel and you will be lauded. Well, Alan Dershowitz was on Newsmax this morning. He called out AOC and the squad as anti-Semites.
AOC is a pure, bigoted anti-Semite. There's nothing Israel could do that is ever right for her, and there's nothing that Israel's enemies that can do that are ever wrong for her. It's amazing to me that she gets reelected in a city like New York, a city that should oppose bigotry. She is the poster child for anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel bigotry. She, along with others on the squad, are one-sided in their condemnation of Israel, no matter what Israel does.
So you have that commentary coming just in the last hours. Over the weekend, CNN firing Adil Raja, a Pakistani freelancer, after he tweeted, "The world today needs a Hitler." By the way, the guy has a history of tweeting stuff just like that. CNN claims he's never been an employee, just a freelancer, and that his reporting contributed to, quote, some news gathering efforts from Islamabad. When asked about this on Fox yesterday, former GW Bush speechwriter Mark Thiessen had this to say.
First of all, it's not just he contributed a couple of things here and there. He wrote 54 articles for CNN, so it's not like he had a tenuous connection to CNN. But second of all, also, this is not new. I mean, this is not related to this conflict. In 2014, he tweeted out that Hail Hitler, and he said he was supporting Germany in the World Cup because Hitler was a German and he did a good job with those Jews. CNN didn't notice that back in 2014. You'd think they'd do better due diligence on their contributors. At least they got rid of him. I mean, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who are virulent anti-Semites, are still on their committees in Congress. Maybe the Democrats ought to take a lesson from CNN and get rid of the anti-Semites in their ranks.
Makes a good point. By the way, how many times was Trump characterized as Hitler? Ditto for Bush. AOC and the other squad members are now comparing the Israeli conflict with apartheid, with Representative Cori Bush, Democrat from Missouri, saying, quote, "We are anti-war, we are anti-occupation, we are anti-apartheid." Rush talked about this a few years ago, recalling his visit to Israel in 1993 and something a soldier said that he never forgot.
Now, let's make no mistake about it. There are a whole lot of Islamic nations in the Middle East who want there to be no Israel. And they want to accomplish this by forcing all citizens of Israel to march into the Mediterranean Sea and drown. I guess if you oppose being murdered, it might make you an Islamophobe to these people. But this is Trump right again. He's just calling it out. The Democrat Party is becoming anti-Jewish. I never thought I would live to actually see this happen. And you need to look at it from this perspective. The Democrat Party is trying to turn Israel into South Africa and the apartheid movement, and they're using the same exact language that they used against South Africa. That's right. Stunning! They are kicking to the curb a major donor base, if nothing else. It's not a full-fledged break. I mean, you've got Pelosi and Schumer and these clowns showing up, the Jurassic Park Democrats. But these young whippersnappers are making it clear that they don't like the Jews. The Jews are Islamophobes. Just like in South Africa, the Afrikaners were a bunch of racists. I will never forget that. That all started, well, it intensified when I was in Sacramento in the Nelson Mandela era. Was he going to go to prison or not? And you had Peter Botha, who was the president of South Africa, and he was doing his best to save South Africa from the African National Congress, which is Mandela's group. And you had American universities in a race with each other to see who could take their investment money out of South Africa the fastest. And Democrat presidential candidates joined that parade, started demanding disinvestment in South Africa. University of California, Berkeley was leading the way out on the left coast. And I remember, this had such an impact. I mean, I can't tell you why. But this was during the fevered pitch where the United States was being pressured. Every American corporation, every individual was being pressured to get the hell out of South Africa. Stop endorsing the apartheid regime. And Winnie Mandela was out there necklacing their enemies, which was putting gasoline in automobile tires and then throwing those tires on their enemies while the flames were lit. And this spokesman for Peter Botha was on with Nightline, and they were trying to rattle this guy by calling him all kinds of names and calling his boss all kinds of names, and he just could not be rattled. No matter what they insulted, no matter what they tried, no matter the allegations, he sat there, and he just, every sentence, he began, "Mr. Botha says, destroy Sub-Saharan Africa, and you will destroy the entire continent." And you should have seen the outraged reaction to that. "Mr. Botha says, destroy white South Africa, and you will destroy all of Sub-Saharan Africa." And they went nuts! And there are beginning to be parallels here. We haven't gotten to the point of Netanyahu is saying destroy Israel and you're going to destroy democracy in the Middle East, but we're not far behind it. But it's this new young Turk bunch of Democrats that are making no bones about the fact that they have no love lost for Israel, no love lost for the Jewish people. And honest folks, I never thought I would live to see the day. Here is Netanyahu in Jerusalem talking about Trump's recognizing the Golan Heights as part of Israel.
He did it again. First, he recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moved the U.S. embassy here. Then he pulled out of the disastrous Iran treaty and reimposed sanctions. But now he did something of equal historic importance. He recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And the message that President Trump has given the world is that America stands by Israel.
Okay, back in 1993, I took a five-day trip to Israel, and I crammed probably what would have been a semester's worth of education into those 5 days. I went to as many places, and I met with as I was Mossad briefing practically every stop, and met with Netanyahu, David Bar-Ilan, who was running the Jerusalem Post at the time, had meetings with Shimon Peres, who kept talking to me about how Reagan was destroying the trees. And then Yitzhak Rabin, which was a fascinating, this was at a time where Clinton and everybody was on the verge of offering the Palestinians everything they wanted to make a deal. And I kept asking Rabin, why are you doing this? Is it generational? Are you tired of constant war and you don't want this for your kids? And he said, no, it's a good deal. Anyway, Arafat turned it down because he didn't want a deal. Clinton did offer everything that Arafat was demanding, and they walked away from it. But one of the stops was to the Golan Heights. And I'd only read about this. I had looked at it on a map. But when you go to these places, Israel is smaller than New Jersey in many ways, 9 miles wide at its most narrow point. And I remember we had a military escort with us, the Golan Heights. And remember, the Israeli Defense Forces, a 22 to 23-year-old young man. And somebody in our group asked him why he was doing what he was doing, why the Israeli Defense Forces is a career and so forth. And he said, I want you to walk over here with me. We were right there at the top, Golan Heights. He said, you see that direction there? And we looked. Right there are people who want to wipe this country off the face of the earth. Now turn and look there. See that? I said, yeah, well, that's another country, and they want to wipe us off the face of the earth. Right there, you had Syria, Jordan. And he could point out the surrounding nations that wanted to eliminate Israel, and they're that close. And that's why the Golan Heights were so strategically important, and they were fought over numerous times. But it's one of the elements of the trip. I'll never forget any of it, but it's one of the elements I remember because it's something we cannot relate to. Our enemies have to cross oceans. They don't anymore. They come in through the southern border. And that's not a joke. That is not a joke. Our enemies can easily come into the southern border. But this is 1993, and while we weren't looking at illegal immigration in the way we do now, our enemies had to launch weapons that had to be able to fly over oceans to get to us. In other words, we couldn't relate. The best we could do is pretend that we're in New York and think of New Jersey as a nation that wants to wipe us out, which is what Israelis face day in and day out. And it changed my perspective on the geostrategic military aspects of Israel's existence, even though they didn't need changing, as it just reinforced them.
An amazing journey, recounted by Rush. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. We took a call from Beth in the last hour from San Antonio, and she was pointing out a number of challenges that we're facing in the country right now, and was concerned that there was not an organized response coming back from the conservatives against the Biden administration, against the Democrats, and what it is that's going on here. So much about elections, and we're still 530 plus days out until the 2022 elections, but so much of what happens in elections are not commanded by what political party is arguing what. It's about circumstances, and we're starting to see a circumstance form that we haven't seen in a very long time. You're hearing analogies to the Carter administration on foreign policy fronts, on the cost of gasoline, on the scarcity of gasoline, and of course, on the I word, inflation. We're starting to see inflation in the economy, and it's becoming worrisome for a number of people. You try to put a wooden fence in your yard. Good luck on buying lumber. Steel has gotten expensive. We had a call from someone yesterday on that very point. Inflation is beginning to manifest itself because we're pumping so much cash into the economy from the government coffers that we're borrowing that you've got too many dollars chasing too few commodities that are out there. And Larry Summers is one of these guys who's starting to raise this alarm. CNN's John Berman invited economist Larry Summers on a new day and with John Berman and Brianna Keeler yesterday morning. Remember, Larry Summers is president emeritus at Harvard University, served as the 71st Secretary of the Treasury for President Clinton and the director of the National Economic Council for President Obama. He's sour on Biden's administration. He didn't hold back on why when appearing yesterday morning to point out that the Biden camp is overheating the economy and causing inflation.
I look at the facts and the amount of money we're putting into households' hands relative to the capacity of the economy to produce. And I look at the serene complacency that we're in a new era and that we can increase demand almost without limit and that we're still trying to get inflation up that we're hearing out of Washington. And I think all of that together is much larger than the kind of extra fiscal policy we had in the 1960s.
So Berman then asks, what would you do about it now if you were in the Biden administration?
First, I'd recognize that our challenge right now is no longer insufficient spending. It's the economy overheating. Second, I'd support the efforts that many states are making to get people back to work by converting unemployment insurance into re-employment bonuses. But overall, this is heavily about expectations and psychology. And I think if we recognize that there is an issue and a problem and make clear a policy commitment to do what's necessary to keep us in a world of stable prices, those expectations can be self-fulfilling. But if we say there isn't any problem and we can let it all rip with policy, those expectations can be self-fulfilling too.
So Rush talked about this and demonstrated how liberals will use inflation.
Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, this is great to have you on the program, sir. Hello.
Hello, Rush. Good afternoon. I think you're exactly right about the liberals' need for a crisis. And I think there's a little long-term planning going on here. And whether it's next year or the year after, it's the inflation crisis. They're deliberately inflating the currency through deficit spending and through monetary policy. And we're going to hear a couple years from now that we need a greater social safety net for seniors because those on fixed income get adversely affected by inflation, for the poor because the poor get adversely affected by inflation. And we can't do it through deficits now. We need to raise taxes.
Exactly. You've nailed it. Excellent. Way to go. You should apply for a fellowship here. You have just nailed exactly what's going to happen. The Federal Reserve, I got a note from a professional golfer friend of mine who had just heard that the Federal Reserve is going to pump $1 trillion into the credit markets. And the professional golfer said, where are we getting this? I said, we are printing this. We don't have this. We are printing this money. $300 billion of it, by the way, to buy the long bond, which is causing bond price or bond yields to plummet. What else is going to happen with inflation? The value of the dollar is going to decrease, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes, sirree, Bob. And so we're going to need exactly what you said. We're going to have chaos. We're going to need tax increases and increased social safety net. Gasoline prices. By the way, the inflation is already starting. Consumer prices rose 0.4% in February. That's the largest amount in 7 months. Gasoline prices went up 8%.
And you're going to hear this is the need for the government to take over more role in energy and price of the crude at the pump and every other sector they can get their hands on. College education, the work.
Well, don't forget, when it gets really bad, then we'll hear the need for price controls. In fact, there already are some economists out there who are now starting to sound the drums
for price controls. Of course, the bourgeois love the notion of price controls. They think that means prices will remain steady. They are deadly. They are one of the worst mistakes that can be made unless you're trying to just turn everything upside down economically. That would create a depression. If that's what they want, that's how they can do it.
So you hear Rush cite a number in that conversation with the caller. That consumer prices rose 0.4% in February. This is back in 09. The largest amount in 7 months. Well, look at the inflation number now. The data last week showed the consumer price index, that's what it costs you to buy stuff, jumped 4.2% from a year earlier. That's the fastest since 2008. Since 2008. So the inflation is there. And what happens? Well, when you have price increases, it gets handed down to the consumer. So the poor are the most hard hit by this inflation. You're you're somebody who's earning $30,000 and you have a set amount of money that you can spend on your groceries. Go try to buy chicken. Go try to buy beef. Go try to buy pork and see what those prices are. They're moving. There have been articles written in a number of newspapers in the last two, three weeks about the price of chicken wings are skyrocketing. And labor costs are skyrocketing because you've got people who are attempting to hire people to work in their restaurants or in their retail locations. And they're bidding against Joe Biden's government because Joe Biden's going to pay them to the end of the year not to work. And on top of that, they're also pumping out billions in universal basic income. This is a potential catastrophe in the making. Larry Summers is right, and I'm glad he's saying it because it shows he's being honest as it relates to the direction of this economy. Plenty more straight ahead. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host on the EIB Network. Wonderful to be here with you. 800-282-2882 is the phone number to be a part of the conversation. As we went to that break, the bottom of the hour, I alluded to this notion of the universal basic income. Larry Summers' critique of the economy with on CNN a couple of days ago, yesterday, is interesting because he's talking about an overheated economy. Too much money is getting pumped into the economy. Well, what if I told you that 88% of children are now going to be covered by monthly payments starting in July, the new child tax credit, with nearly 9 of 10 children covered by a monthly payment of between $250 and $300 per month. Just getting sent out. You got kids, you get $250 ahead or $300 ahead. That's what you got. It's incredible. This is socialism. Rush talked about this as a test for millennials. Is universal basic income sustainable?
Milton Friedman, the great economist, said it's just obvious that you cannot have free immigration and a welfare state. Now, the left and all of their members, the left says we must have open borders. And they give as their reason social justice. And it's all rooted in this cockamamie belief the United States has spread misery and suffering around the world. And we've done it in any number of ways. Our superpower status derives from theft and consumption. We've simply gone out around the world and taken everything we wanted. We stole it from there. We stole it from over there. We took it from that group. We took it from that country. We've enriched ourselves at the expense of the world. And so the world is in dire straits because we exist as a superpower. It's simply, it's not fair. It's not right that one country should have so much and the rest of the world should have so little. And so the left believes in open borders. And not just open borders. The left believes in guaranteed welfare to those who get here, one way or another. And now, have you noticed, universal income is said to be the ultimate answer to the future. Universal income, you know what that is? We are a nation $20 trillion in debt. We have an additional this is going to boggle your mind, $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities. And we have people like Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Elon Musk and the rest of the glitterati in Silicon Valley suggesting that what we need to have here is universal income, free money. Because, of course, the future is artificial intelligence, which means robots, which means massive unemployment. Progress, technological progress, must mean people will lose their jobs and be replaced by machines. And Silicon Valley doesn't want to feel guilty about that. So here comes universal income. So open borders, guaranteed welfare to those who get here one way or another, and now universal income, the ultimate answer. Now, I missed the part about unlimited revenues. Where do the unlimited revenues to pay for all this come from? Where do we get that? Well, we don't. We're not going to have the money to pay for all of this. Now, you square that. You millennials, you love sustainability. What we're doing here is simply not sustainable. We can't sustain a nation of growth and prosperity with something called free money and universal income. We just can't do it. We can't do it with open borders. You want to feed the world because the United States has led to starvation around the world? You want the world to have free health care because the United States doesn't share its great health care? You want everybody to have a guaranteed income? What, you want the world to come here for all of it? Are there no limits on it? You want the whole world to come here? Is that what our price must be for our racism, for our slavery, for our bigotry, for our feminism, for our homophobia, for all of these ills that we have engaged in? The world must be permitted to come here. I have an idea. I have a little test, and I'm serious. I know a lot of you in this audience are young people. You are millennials. Some of you are college students. I know you're there. I know you're there in droves. We have the audience research to prove it. We know you're out there. And I have a little test for you. How about you're either already started school at university or it's coming up. It's very soon. Either way, have an idea. Why don't each of you take in a bunch of new roommates and provide them everything they want and need? You do it. Under the idea of fairness, under the idea that you may have more, you may have less, but you should do it. If free money, universal income, guaranteed welfare, unending health care, if this is the answer, you do it. Do a little test lab. Provide it for your roommates and see how it works and get back to us. Tell us how it works out. I mean, working millennials can't even afford their student loans, much less ESPN now. Now, the moral of the story is, when you don't have the money, you shouldn't take on obligations you can't sustain. And we don't have the money for any of this. Not to mention the morality here is all wrong. And not the fact that doing all this is really, at the end of the day, not helpful to anybody. Because all it's going to do is create people that are ill-equipped and unprepared to fend for themselves.
And the crazy part of this is the notion of the Great Reset that you hear people talking about, like Klaus Schwab over at the over in Europe. They think that you can just do this on the global scale. We'll just give everybody a house, give everybody transportation, give everybody money and food and stuff, and it'll just be, it's a utopia. No, it is. It's actually a utopia. It doesn't exist. And the idea that you think for a moment that people are going to put up with this, it's absolutely loony. You know, you look at how this situation ends up, and it ends up the same way it has in the past in the Soviet Union. Poverty, desperation. Because at some point, you're going to be pumping out money to everybody. You're bringing everybody into the country. And you're going to have people who decide they want to take stuff from everybody else. You will end up with a tribalist kind of a model where one group of people is going to gang up on another group of people to take their stuff. And then how are you supposed to backfill all of that? Well, you can't. The beauty of a free market system is the fact that a free market system works. And the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the historical track record of where we were, say, in 1776 versus where we are now, the economy has grown exponentially. The global economy has grown exponentially. But by and large, has been driven by the American economy in the last 100 years. And we didn't make all that money by stealing money from poor people because poor people don't have money. We create products. We create services. We create things that people want to use. China is the opposite model. They decide, well, you know what? We'll just pirate all the technology. We don't have to do any R&D, and we'll just manufacture stuff at a much cheaper rate. It's like a pirate economy. It's not hard to understand that there is no free lunch. There just isn't one. Somebody pays that tab somewhere along the line. Why do you think so many people are probably running and hiding in cryptocurrency? Because they're going, uh-oh, this is going to get bad fast. I better go somewhere else and figure something else out. And I want to... Only the politicians can dream this kind of stuff up. You know what? We like to think that you should be able to use your cell phone as often as you like without worrying what the monthly cell phone bill is going to be. Now, one company gives you a definitive answer, Pure Talk. And that answer is $30 a month. If you're with Verizon, AT&T, or T-Mobile, switching to Pure Talk will save you money. In fact, Pure Talk saves the average family of four over $800 a year. The best part of that is you don't have to sacrifice coverage. That's because it's on the exact same network as one of those three providers. Switching is so easy. You can keep your phone, keep your number, and with one cell phone call to Pure Talk, you can get started today. When you do switch to Pure Talk, you get unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data for just $30 a month. And if you go over on data, they don't charge you for it. When Rush heard story of Pure Talk and how they handle their customer service all here in the United States, he started sharing the Pure Talk story. He saw it as a benefit to you. Their CEO is a U.S. veteran who understands what real service means. You'll get to experience that level of care when you talk to their customer service team. You do that by making a single phone call on your cell phone, just 4 digits. Just dial #250 and say keyword Pure Talk to save 50% off your first month. That's #250. Say Pure Talk. You'll have the option to receive a one-time auto-dialed text message from Pure Talk. It's an amazing service. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. 800-282-2882 is the phone number to be a part of the conversation. I am Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Let's go out on the phones and check in with Susan in Kansas. Next up, Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brett. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for calling.
Mega dittos to all the Rush family.
Amen.
I sure miss Rush.
We do, too. We do, too.
I just wanted to say that we're seeing proof right now that UBI will not work because nobody will go back to work because of all the money they're getting from the government right now. And the sad reality is, if this were to happen, we would have no more products because nobody would go to work to make them.
Yep.
So we'd just end up like Cuba or Venezuela and be poor and without anything.
Yeah, it's a great point, Susan, because when you look across the arc of history, you say to yourself, okay, what system best competes with a market economy? And really, all you have offered up is what Marxism and socialism, right? Okay, you could have feudalism where the king has all the money and you have peasantry and you've got royals like what you have over in, you know, in the old medieval times, right, there in Europe. But the market economy works from the earliest days of humanity. You know, one caveman traded with another caveman for some beads or did this or did that. And so the reality is markets exist. They just do. And it's a natural occurring thing. Government has a role. Government has a role to make sure somebody's not robbed, to make sure somebody's not cheated, to make sure that there's a functioning court system to adjudicate differences. But socialism doesn't do that. Socialism says, Susan's got a great car. You know, we need a car for the vice president. We're just going to take Susan's car. Communism says nobody gets a car except the guy at the top of the chain. Nobody gets a house except the Politburo, those people. And all that really ends up being is a gangsterism enslaving an entire country. So, yeah, the market economy is where you go. Universal basic income is nonsense. It's a sort of thing dreamt up over a few too many beers or other sort of intoxicating endeavors. It sounds great at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Friday night with your friends sitting around in a bar, but it will never work. It just will never work. And there are people who will say, well, it just hasn't been tried yet. No, we are the biggest economy in the world, maybe in world history, likely in world history. We will not be able to get that thing to work. No doubt in my mind. 800-282-2-8. I mean, it's what it comes down to, Susan. And I appreciate you being out there. Casey in Oklahoma City. Welcome to the show, Casey.
Hey, Brett. How's it going?
Going well, thanks.
Hey, so my question is essentially, who is in charge of the police? And the whole reason I ask that question is because throughout the past year, we've had our politicians violate the Constitution and violate their oath to uphold the Constitution. Mm-hmm. With that being said, who are we supposed to go to demand that that person who just violated their oath to uphold the Constitution be held accountable and be arrested?
So when you say politician, are you saying an elected official or an appointed official?
I am talking about mayors and city council members specifically. Yeah.
Well, those are people you have to vote out. You have to get them out. You have to wait for another election to turn them out as a result of that.
So there's no way at all that a sheriff or an attorney general could arrest a politician, an elected politician that's violating the law?
Well, no, that's not the point at all. The point is, if you have a local mayor who's dealing drugs, the attorney general could prosecute him. The district attorney could prosecute him in that regard, right? Violating their oath, that's going to be something that would have to be adjudicated in a court setting. So, for example, California is looking to recall Gavin Newsom. Very few states have a recall provision for a governor, okay? But in California, they're going to try to recall him. If you go to New York State, you can't recall Cuomo. You'd have to impeach him. There are mechanisms to remove people from office. It's just written there in the in the charters and in the documents and the state constitutions of these areas. But you got to go read them, and you got to figure out how to then turn them out. But the idea of an angry mob going in and pulling them out, or a sheriff going and arresting them, I think that's a challenge that is not going to bear fruit. And maybe that's an unpopular take, but that's my thought. 800-282-2882 is the number to be a part of the conversation. Bo Snerdly himself joined this program this past Wednesday to speak with Todd Herman about his new podcast series. It's quite a tribute to our beloved Rush, sharing memorable moments of working together and the kind of person that Rush was. MyPillow and Tunnel to Towers Foundation are both sponsoring this 12-episode series. You'll find a link to the first podcast on the website at rushlimbaugh.com, rushlimbaugh.com, and wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network on the Rush Limbaugh Show. You know what? I'm going to grab a call real quick here, Mike, if I can. Let me take this call on Ken in Florida. Ken, welcome to the EIB Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, welcome to you. Thank you for talking. I really miss Rush. I listened to this morning on Beck's show, and they released Joe Biden's taxes this morning, and they said that his income was $607,000. Now, is it true that he has three or four houses? And if that's the case, then how is $607,000 that we know in 50 years of office that there's a heck of a lot more money that's missing out of those accounting?
Okay.
And as I was talking to your guy that was screening me on the phone,
right,
is that all these agencies are all funneled with all these dumb rap people in there that they create different policies that people like us are working.
You're right. No, you're right. Ken, you're right. You are right. You are spot on. Now, here's the thing, and this is a perfect segue for what's coming up here next, because people have had it with the political class in this country. It's rules for thee and not for me. And you've got people that game the system and take full advantage of what it is that's going on out there in the world. And people have had it. I'm furious with it. You're furious with it. In fact, here's Rush talking about being fed up.
The American population, the working class of this country, has wanted to tell a political class where to go for I don't know how long. They do every day. They shout at the television sets at home when they're talking to each other. They talk this way about the ruling class.
Absolutely. And we will dive into that. Brett Winterbull on the EIB Network. It is an honor to be here with the greatest audience on the greatest radio program in radio history. And that is the Rush Limbaugh Show. 800-282-2882 is our phone number to be a part of our discussion, of our conversation. The end of that last hour, you heard something from Rush that's incredibly important and will form this entire hour. And that is the fact that we, the people, the American people, are fed up with the political class. Now, the political class doesn't just mean the class ruling in Washington, D.C. In so many ways, it's big tech now. And of course, it's the university system. It's the special interest groups that shape policy. Think about what it was that you saw when it came to Randy Weingarten and the AFT shaping CDC policy on schools reopening. And more than that, it's the entertainment industry as well. I'm old enough to remember when Saturday Night Live was able to entertain by poking fun at pretty much everybody. Now, Rush said for years that the so-called comedy shows aren't comedy anymore, and that they're where millennial liberals go to actually get their news. Additionally, he pointed out that in the day and age of viral videos and Twitter, ratings don't matter.
It stuns me, but in a lot of television, ratings don't matter. I want to go back because this sets up a giant "see, I told you so." This is me right here behind the golden EIB microphone.
I had a instant message flash going back and forth about ratings late night, and I offered the following opinion to the person I was talking with. I said, it's obvious that ratings don't matter anywhere near as much as they used to. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a CNN. There would not be an MSNBC. If ratings mattered, they wouldn't exist. Nobody's watching. I think television executives, management types, programmers are more influenced by what the media says about a talent or a show than what the ratings are. I find this fascinating because as a culture now, it seems more and more everybody's obsessed with what is said about them. So you're going to see, as a result, in the media, you're going to see more PR campaigns, and you're going to see more people hiring image-making PR firms to craft a public image, and somebody's longevity is going to be based more on what the media says about them and their show than what their ratings are. Because if you're Lorne Michaels, if the media loves Fallon, who cares who's watching? If the media loves him, that means you love Lorne Michaels, because Lorne Michaels picked the guy. It means Lorne Michaels' a brilliant guy, regardless what the numbers are.
Amen. Who can dispute that? Nobody can. Okay, so let's go to Les Moonves now, the CEO of the CBS Tiffany Network Empire, in Los Angeles at the Milken Institute Global Conference. Moonves on a panel entitled Entertainment, the Big Picture. The co-president of Billboard and Hollywood Reporter, Janice Min, speaking with Les Moonves about late night TV. And she said, can you talk about the economics of late night and why they matter still? Remember what you just heard me say.
Late night is not what it used to be. During the days of Johnny Carson, even the early days of David Letterman, it was much more of a profit center for all of us. The last few years, it's been more about bragging rights, and clearly we're at a point where there's a real generational change. Late night is a very important part of our culture. It is not as economically profitable as it used to be, so they make a lot about the ratings, you know, and that really doesn't affect the bottom line, so I'd rather have the best guy, maybe, that doesn't quite have the ratings of the other guy.
Well, folks, I mean, there you have it. It's the guy that hired Colbert. The ratings don't matter. It's not nearly the profit center for us. This is about bragging rights. This is about who appears the smartest executive picking the best guy. Do I know these people? Do I know this business, or do I? He just admitted it. He said here it's not as economically profitable
make a lot about the ratings. The ratings don't really affect the bottom line. If the ratings don't affect the bottom line, then what does? Media buzz and PR. Now, there's one more Moonves soundbite. Janice Min, Hollywood reporter, then said, are you concerned about Stephen Colbert? Because there's been just the slightest hint, of people expressing concern about the political views he has expressed on Comedy Central.
You know what? Ironically, Stephen Colbert is much more moderate than people think he is. He's a great social commentator, and that's sort of what we want. That's sort of what David Letterman has been. If you're referring to remarks from Rush Limbaugh that we have attacked the heartland of America, I would respectfully disagree with that assessment of who Stephen Colbert is. And as one reporter said, so suddenly Rush is going soft on Letterman?
I don't get the connection there. What does one have to do with the other? Rush going soft on Letterman. Letterman's the same thing. But anyway, you see, ratings don't matter. He wanted to go out and he wanted bragging rights. He hired a guy. He doesn't even know who he really is. He hired a guy, a character, who makes fun of conservatives, Colbert, who then they promptly said he's dropping the character. So now CBS has hired a guy that the question is, who is he? It still doesn't matter because Les got his bragging rights. He got the hip guy. Why does this matter? I'll tell you why it matters. It's because we're straying further and further from reality. And we're being consumed by what isn't real. We're being consumed by what we're told is important, what we're told is real. And substance, reality, are falling by the wayside each and every day. Comedians are gradually replacing the New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS, NBC, PBS, ABC, CNN, as the arbiters of when Democrats can be held accountable and when they can't be. So if you want to know when the drive-bys are going to harp on Obama, pay attention to the comedians. When they do, it's a signal to the drive-bys that it's okay to. It's very pathetic. And it's how you end up with low-information voters who don't know what the hell is going on. It's how you end up with millennials down on the country, down on themselves, rather than on the people responsible for the mess that we live in, and that's the Democrat Party.
And the truth of the matter is, as Rush notes, comedians are gradually replacing the New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS, NBC, PBS, ABC, CNN, the arbiters of when Democrats can be held accountable. And what has happened to the comedians? They have been replaced yet again by another group. What we see happening now in our culture, in our entertainment, is we have replaced a ratings score with a social credit score, which is what the Chinese have pioneered to control the people inside China. And that openly discussed by people in Silicon Valley, that's the model moving forward. The most woke person is the most important person, all that sort of stuff. Saturday Night Live's numbers cratered to their lowest ratings ever with 3.5 million viewers. All that despite Olivia Rodrigo singing Driver's License. Lowest ratings ever. And that's just 1 week after Elon Musk's hosting gig. That's with Keegan-Michael Key hosting. It cratered. So I guess in the metric of what Les Moonves is talking about, it was an unbelievable successful thing. We are attracting an elite 3.5 million people out of 330 million rubes. It's like one of those restaurants, you know, where you go in and there's like three tables, you know, in New York City or Hollywood or whatever. And you go, I'm going to go in. It's such an elite restaurant. There's literally one chair in the restaurant. You can't even bring a date. It's so elite. It's ridiculous to look at this. So this is the new ruling political class. You know, when you hear frustration from people, like we heard from a caller earlier, in the idea that, well, they're doing all this stuff and how do we stop it? The reality is conservatives are checking out from so many of these platforms. I know tons of conservatives that don't watch SNL any longer. I know tons of conservatives that wouldn't be caught dead watching any of the late night offerings that are there, because you have been told as a consumer, as a television consumer, as an entertainment consumer, that you're not welcome to view the program. They don't want you in the audience. Well, then why am I going to stay up till 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning? And why am I going to, DVR it and watch it in the morning the next day if I've been told that they don't want me watching it? And I'm not going to think most of the jokes are funny, and I'm going to think they're kind of obvious. So when you look at the way this is moving, the political elites continue to afflict us, especially the elected officials. Your Andrew Cuomo's and your Bill Clinton's and that group of people, Bill de Blasio, they continue to afflict us because they have the ability to control policy. They have the ability to raise your taxes to determine your future and how you live. But even their conservatives are opting out. They're leaving New York City. They're leaving the state of New York. They're leaving California and Los Angeles and San Francisco, and they're going to places where they'll be welcomed. And where are the places that are adding population? Organic American population. It's the red states, the conservative states, the states with low taxes. And I guarantee you there's a correlation. If you were to put up a map of the United States and a ratings map of what was going on at SNL or the late night shows or any of that, I guarantee you the correlation will be clear. It'll be New York and L.A. and Washington, D.C. and Chicago watching these shows. Yay. And even out of the 100 million people or whatever that number is between those cities, you're still only drawing 3.5 million. That's embarrassing. We're watching the extinction of a medium. And it's because of the politics. They're completely out of step, and they're no longer edgy. They are the overclass. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Oh, the arrogance of Andy Cuomo. This is just unbelievable. Yesterday in New York City at Radio City Music Hall, Governor Andrew Cuomo held a press conference. And an unidentified reporter asks him, have you ever had an intimate relationship with a fellow state employee?
Intimate has a number of manifestations. I think we have an intimate relationship. Don't you think that? Yeah. Not a sexual relationship.
Oh, that was Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, talking to the health commissioner, Howard Zucker, about whether or not they have an intimate relationship. Reminds me of another prominent Democrat.
It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yeah. Bubba. Rush reminds us that Andrew Cuomo, who, by the way, just sold the rights to his best-selling pandemic memoir for $5.12 million, according to tax returns that he made public on Monday. That's according to the New York Post reporting. Yes, that's the same Cuomo who forced nursing homes to accept COVID-19 patients, which had been tied to as many as 1,000-plus deaths. It's also the same Cuomo that was involved in another scandal that Rush reminded us about.
Andrew Cuomo is hip-deep in the subprime mortgage crisis. I do know that a lot of people are fully aware that the subprime mortgage fiasco is why, primary reason why we're in this economic mess that we're in now. The subprime mortgage mess, when explained to people, is easy to understand. You're going to loan money to people who can't afford it? You're going to loan money to people who never pay it back? You're going to call it affordable housing and you're going to bail them out? We're going to be paying for all this? We're out here struggling to get mortgages. We're struggling to pay them back on time, and now you're loaning money to a bunch of people, and all you're really doing is buying votes. In the process, you're screwing up property values. You're messing up the market big time. Andrew Cuomo is at the forefront of this program. And this is what more and more people are starting to learn. Andrew Cuomo's been involved in policies that have genuinely harmed people, that have genuinely negatively impacted the country. The American population, the working class of this country, has wanted to tell a political class where to go for I don't know how long. They do every day. They shout at the television sets at home when they're talking to each other.
People have had it. You've had it. I've had it. It's unbelievable. Let's go out and talk to Bruce in Georgia. Bruce, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today, sir?
Oh, how you doing? It's Bruce Lawn.
Yes, sir.
So I want to let you all know, or what let you know, that I appreciate what you guys are doing. I don't listen to you guys on the radio, but I do listen to you guys on Spotify. And I started listening a couple months after Rush died. I don't really know much about him except the sound bites you guys put on, you know, the air. But just letting you know that you guys have opened up my eyes, and keep up the good work. And then one more thing, I have an issue, and Rush, I'll make this quick here. Rush said something about not worrying what people think, and I have that problem. So I'm a little nervous, but there's no reason to be nervous. That's really it. I mean,
okay.
I keep listening to you guys.
Well, appreciate you being there. We appreciate you being there, Bruce. And that's, look, Rush's analysis, Rush's takes on these big issues are timeless. They're absolutely timeless. And that's a hugely important thing to recognize, because he was an incredibly special person who understood human nature, political nature, and the way the world operates and functions. And so whether you're a new listener or you've been with him for 25 or 30 years, you're going to find the analysis, the things he talks about are absolutely timeless because they're true. Evan is on the road in Wyoming. Evan, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, hello. How you doing? Just want to say hello from America Held Hostage.
Amen.
And you remember that from Rush's old TV show? Remember that one?
Of course, absolutely.
So anyway, I was talking about there's work out here. There's work everywhere I go. Every single warehouse I go to, every place I stop, help wanted signs. All the truck stops, help wanted signs. Here's a place I like to stop here in Wyoming. You can go inside and get a meal, but that takes time. So I go to the fuel line, the little kiosk they have out there.
Sure.
They make some great pork chops. Half the time, there's nobody even there. They can't even get people to work.
Yeah.
And fuel's going up. Mm-hmm. I've been on the road since December 23rd.
Holy cow.
All kinds of stuff. Yeah. Hauling everything you've ever imagined. Medical supplies, food supplies. I've even got paperwork that says I can run extra hours. I don't even have to obey the DOT rules if I'm hauling COVID-sensitive product.
Wow.
So it gets to go.
And there's a massive trucker shortage as well. People need to understand that as well. You are very busy because there is a shortage of people with your expertise.
Well, they don't want to pay us.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for 20 years now, and I pretty much make the same money I made 20 years ago. Yeah. And taxes are up. Fuel taxes are up.
Oh, sure.
Fuel taxes are up. Emission taxes are up.
Yep. And
cargo.
Inflation.
Insurance is up. Inflation is up. You know, you can't even, there. If you go to a McDonald's, just to use a generic name,
yes,
at a truck stop, there's not even a dollar menu. You can't even get dollar menu.
Wow. Wow. That's unbelievable. So, Evan, it's a great point that you raise. Look, economic decisions taken by the government, co-signed by the Congress, you pump all this cash into the economy, you pump all the money out there, and you hope that it's just going to work. It has consequences. These decisions are not made in a vacuum. So if you pump out $3 trillion, that $3 trillion is going to travel through the economy, and there are going to be people who get their money and they say, you know what, I'm just not interested in leaving the house. Stephen Moore refers to them all the time as the Netflix unemployed. They're sitting at their home watching movies all day. There are millions of open jobs. I'm Brett Witterbull on the EIB Network. Let's turn to the city of New York, which has been in the headlines for so many reasons over the last number of years. But this most recent reason is something that I think is worthy of celebration, though I would never take advantage of it. And that's the fact that New York City's 24-hour subway service has resumed 1 year after COVID-19 shutdown. So the subways are now going to be running 24 hours a day. You can travel hither, dither, and yon. And, you know, basically select a time that's convenient for you to be mugged or harassed by the folks that are riding on those trains. And that's the real shame, because New York City is a place that I lived in, that I loved my time in. I love the city of New York. It is the politicians, the politics that make it horrible, that make it horrible. The New York City Police Department is a proud and storied tradition when it comes to law enforcement. I still remember the heroism on September the 11th, but I've also witnessed acts of heroism on random days being in the city of New York and watching law enforcement officers protect individuals from being harmed or killed and rescuing children who had been injured or were sick. The cops are a fundamentally good force, and I don't care what Bill de Blasio says, and I don't care what the protesters want to say, but now comes a new challenge. A New York City Pride Parade has banned the police. That's right. The New York City Pride Parade is banning the police. Gay officers are now disheartened about this. Even crazy Bill de Blasio is calling the ban of the New York City police officers from New York City Pride events a mistake. The New York Post reports it this way. Organizers of the world's largest gay pride event, NYC Pride, announced Saturday that the police and corrections officer exhibitors will not be allowed to participate for at least the next 5 years, and that the event would hire private security to reduce NYPD presence during the march. NYC Pride co-chair Andre Thomas said the decision follows many months of conversation and discussion with key stakeholders in the community. Did you talk to the cops? Did they talk to the police? I'm guessing they didn't. The police are not part of, quote, the community. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, Mayor Wilhelm, responded to the policy yesterday during his daily press conference.
I think that decision's a mistake. First of all, we have to keep people safe. Second of all, you know, I believe in inclusion.
He believes in inclusion. Of who? Of who, Bill? I mean, you can say you believe in inclusion, but how are you manifesting it? Are you going to be attending the gay pride parade? Are you going to speak up for the men and women of law enforcement? The radical left doesn't believe the police keep people safe. The only inclusion they're interested in is their own. You can't be a gay cop. You can't be a Republican cop. You can't be a transgender cop. No, that's not the inclusion they're talking about. It's only one-way inclusion and one-way tolerance, full stop. Here's Rush on the left's intolerance as a one-way street.
When we lose and we regroup and we try to fight our battles internally, as is happening now, and we try to come back and win. And we always try to win by persuading as many minds and hearts as possible to agree with us. The left isn't that. They don't care about persuading anybody. They are thugs. There's a big argument going on between gay rights activists and black activists. You know, the N-word's being thrown around by a bunch of leftists, these people of tolerance. Isn't it fascinating that these people who demand tolerance, particularly the militant homosexual groups that mobilize politically like this, they're the ones out there demanding all kinds of tolerance for their lifestyle and their desires and who they are. They have none. You notice how so many liberal concepts are one-way streets. Tolerance is a one-way. They don't have to tolerate anything. They don't have to tolerate tradition. They don't have to tolerate defeat. They don't have to tolerate a majority opposing them. They don't have to. They can protest and they can intimidate and they can get judges to overturn the will of the people if they want. They can go out and destroy or try to destroy the churches that are populated by people that disagree with the militant gay rights agenda. So they don't have to be tolerant. We have to be tolerant. We have to be tolerant. Understand their grievance as a minority. I mean, the battle for the heart and soul of the country is wide open, and it's happening right in front of our eyes.
The thing that's always overlooked about law enforcement is, especially in a place like New York or any other big metropolitan area, the police department is diverse. It's usually very heavily minority. Some communities, it's majority minority. You look at a big city police department, you've got a lot of different people. You want to talk about diversity? Look at the New York City Police Department with, what is it, 40,000 cops? That's going to have you're going to have a very diverse group of people in that universe of people. By and large, cops come from middle or working class backgrounds. These are not necessarily Harvard grads with degrees in underwater basket weaving and wokeism. These are people who said, you know what? I have a real desire to serve people, to help people out in the same way that you may have a vocation to be an EMT, a medic, a paramedic, a fireman, a police officer, a corrections officer, a doctor, a public defender in the court system, a social worker. These are all jobs that are in that same general universe. Newspaper reporters, the press, that used to be a working class job. Now it's elite Harvard, Yale, Stanford job, where you have these people who have worked so hard to put themselves into the elite class that they then get to turn their noses down at other people. And one does wonder with these organizers of this Pride March between now and 2025, I take a great deal of ironic joy in thinking about how it is they're going to prohibit police officers from coming to their event and yet will think nothing of picking up the phone to call the police on the lunatic that's in the lobby of their building smashing windows because he's out of his mind on drugs or alcohol or he has psychiatric issues. And they're going to call the police and say, you have to come here. He's destroying our property. Come here right now, please. Or you better get here or else. They won't see the irony. The left never does, because it is a one-way street, as Rush said, 100% of the time. It is a one-way street. Brian is in North Carolina next up. Brian, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, I called basically trying to look for some advice from you. I'm in North Carolina, obviously. I'm working from home, have been for the last year and so, I don't know, 2 months. But they recently sent out, you know, the updated guidance from the CDC about the masks. Mm-hmm. I work at a business right now where people are rotating every 2 weeks going into the office. So it's like a third of the employees go in for 2 weeks, and then they switch. Another third goes in for 2 weeks and so on. And then when you're not at work, you're working from home. And then for people who can't go into work because there were mask requirements or whatever the reason was that they couldn't go into work, they had to get a doctor's notice and then they could stay and work at home. But now they're trying to get people to go back into work, mm-hmm. but they still have the mask requirement if you are not vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
So my problem is that I've got breathing issues. Do I have a disability? No, I do not. My doctor does not want to say that I have a disability. I've got asthma. I've got sinus problems. I've got a deviated septum. All of this makes it really hard for me to breathe in a mask for more than like 2 minutes at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The problem with that, though, is that from what I understand at work, they have people walking around checking to see, do you have your mask on? And if you don't have your mask on, you get written up. If you get written up 3 times, you get fired.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I don't want to go into work because I don't want to get fired because I know I will take my mask off because I have to. It's almost like I get claustrophobic wearing the mask and I have to take it off. I just cannot breathe after, literally after like 2 minutes. I cannot breathe in the mask.
Well, have you thought about going to a doctor and getting a note from a doctor attesting to that fact? I mean, that's the,
But that's the thing. My doctor is like, okay, this is not a disability. Your sinus condition is not a disability. And if you do want me to classify it as a disability, think about what that means to you. And I'm like, okay, legally, I'm not really sure.
Here's the thing, Brian. I'm not a lawyer. I would recommend maybe you want to seek legal counsel. Get some advice from a lawyer. It sounds like it's worth, you know, if this is that traumatic to you, and I'm not de-emphasizing that at all, but if this is that big of an important issue to you, I would reach out maybe to some competent counsel and ask for advice from a lawyer to see what your rights are. Maybe your rights are different in North Carolina versus someplace else. That's really the best I could do for you. I understand the frustration. We are all frustrated, and I get that you are in a unique position. So I would just say reach out to somebody who's got much better legal knowledge than I would have on the radio for you. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Now, your EIB high note. a retirement home for horses. Yesterday, we brought you a couple of horse stories, the Preakness Champion, as well as the one about the federal government program that was intended to help wild horses, but who actually ended up hurting them instead. People exploited the program for their own personal gain, and these majestic animals were slaughtered. Well, today we have a positive counter to that with the story out of Georgetown, Kentucky, about a nonprofit that's truly devoted to helping these majestic animals. Old Friends is a sprawling 275-acre retirement home for thoroughbred racehorses. It was founded in 2003 by former Boston Globe film critic Michael Blowen after he learned that the 1986 Kentucky Derby winner Ferdinand had died in a slaughterhouse. Blowen wanted to give these horses the retirement they deserved, whether they won on the track or not. There are now over 200 residents, but he admits he has a soft spot for one former champion named Silver Charm.
I can't imagine a happier person on the planet Earth because I get to wake up every morning and see Silver Charm every day, every day.
That was the champion in 97, I believe. Silver Charm, a beautiful horse. Old Friends receives no government funding. In fact, they have a veterinarian that works with them that has been doing it out of the goodness of his heart. And you can see this great video profile of their work over at rushlimbaugh.com. That's rushlimbaugh.com. And you can see the tremendous work that's been done with this rescue, with these horses. Horses are such incredible, incredible animals. They have all got their own personality, like you'd expect with any pet. But these horses are remarkable because they are bathed in the glory of victory at the highest possible level. And then in some cases, forgotten, cast off, or worse. Check it out at rushlimbaugh.com. Let me talk to Nettie in Warrenton, Virginia. Nettie, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir. Brett, I appreciate you taking my call.
I appreciate you.
Listen, as you know, this country, as well as all citizens of, mm-hmm. is in trouble with this leadership and this administration that we've got.
Yes, ma'am.
The damage that he has done in the 3.5 months that he has been there is unacceptable, to say the least. What in the world is going to be taking place in the next 3.5 months? My question to you would be, isn't there some way that we can eliminate this administration? And I say not eliminate him.
Sure, sure.
The military or the Supreme Court, can they not step in?
No, the answer... The answer is no in that regard. We have a system in place where we have elections. They're set at intervals. But what can be done is something that's, you may not love the answer, but I'm sincere when I give it. And it's this. The states have a very strong role to play here. You've got states that are clearly led by people who understand the stakes. People like Governor Abbott in Texas and DeSantis in Florida. McMaster in South Carolina. And these are people, Kristi Noem in South Dakota. These are people who need to sue and who need to tie them up in court. We need to rely on our conservative senators and Congress people to do what they can to get this done. And it's ultimately up to us to persuade our friends that are persuadable in our immediate circles to understand what the stakes are and to make better choices moving forward. All it takes is one senator to retire in the Senate, and the balance of power can switch instantaneously. And we are seeing that these Democrats in the House are not confident because more and more of them are announcing retirements or making decisions to run for other public office. They know the clock is ticking on this insane agenda being put forth. So, no, we can't rely on the military or the Supreme Court. We have to rely on our own political mechanisms at the federal and at the state level. Thank you for calling, Nettie. All the best. I'm Brett Witterbull. It is the Rush Limbaugh Show. It's an important question that Nettie asked us in that last segment, and it's a vitally important question. You know, what can we do? Believe me, there are people who think about that every single day as you look at the direction of this country. The most important thing I think we can do, and it's going to sound like a weak answer, but I promise you it's not a weak answer. What we can do is continue to pray for our country and to pray for our leaders, even the ones that we don't necessarily agree with or like. We have to pray that they will turn away from what it is that they're doing and understand that there's a better pathway. The best way to get even with your enemies is to pray for them, to get them to come around. But what Rush, I think, would have said most importantly is not to lose heart, to understand that this is a great country. We are a great nation. We are a good nation. We are a good people. We have to be confident in that, not by the nonsense coming out of Washington and beyond. It has been a pleasure to be here today. I'll be with you tomorrow. Brett Winterbull on the EIB Network.